What's up and welcome to the NYC Video Podcast, a show about the film and video industry here in New York and the great people that are making it happen. I'll be your host, Tom Chavez, and each week I'll be interviewing other New York filmmakers to learn more about their craft, their process, and share their stories about their careers. For today's show, I'm thrilled to be talking with Brooklyn-based cinematographer, photographer, and visual engineer, Steve Giralt. He and his team are responsible for that slow-motion Hershey S'mores spot that we've all seen on Instagram and Facebook. For those of you who aren't familiar with his work, stop this show right now and go look on his Instagram. Steve has shot commercials and social media content for brands like Dunkin' Donuts, Pepsi, Budweiser, and Heinz, to name a few. Steve's studio, which he calls The Garage, is located in Industry City, Brooklyn. He and his team are pioneers of what he calls visual engineering, applying robotics and synchronized camera movement to breathe life into food, beverages, and product videos. With the help of a phantom camera, custom-built lights, robotic arms, and pneumatic catapults, Steve and his team nail butter-smooth shots of whiskey being poured over ice cubes or a piece of chocolate melting over marshmallow. Also in this episode, we talk to Steve about his next venture, The Garage Learning, an online portal where filmmakers can go and learn step-by-step how to build their own rigs and execute these kinds of tech-heavy shots on their own. Anyway, let's jump into today's interview with Steve Giralt. If you're looking for a gourmet kitchen space for your next video production, check out Cooktop Studios, located on the waterfront in Sunset Park, Brooklyn. The space is 3,600 square feet in size, and it gets lots of natural soft light. The kitchen is outfitted with Deccan countertops, finished cabinetry, and induction ranges and convection ovens. There's also an ice maker, dishwasher, and multiple refrigerators for your food stylists. Getting to the studio is super easy. It's minutes away from the BQE, subway, bus, or ferry boat. Cooktop also has on-site parking for production vehicles, clients, and crew. To learn more about Cooktop Studio and to see a video walkthrough of the space, visit cooktopstudio.com. Also, be sure to follow them on Instagram to see behind-the-scenes photos that other productions post on social media. I'll leave the links in our show notes. If you end up booking the space, you can get a discount by mentioning the promo code NYCVideoPodcast. Happy shooting and bon appetit. Okay, so I'm here today with Steve Giralt, and we're going to be talking shop about his process and working as a visual engineer. How are you, Steve?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Let's just jump right into it. How did you get started in video production?
I landed in video production through still photography. So I studied still photography at Rochester Institute of Technology. I moved to New York. I worked as a photo assistant and then kind of as a digital tech working on still shoots. And then, you know, I kind of started my own studio in here in Manhattan. Actually, it was my first studio. And then after about a decade of doing that, I started getting bored and started getting into a little more crazy things like what I do now. And that kind of came in a bit of a roundabout way, but I was really just excited about getting into making amazing videos.
Cool. And what year did you move to New York?
I moved to New York in 2002.
Okay. And I assume New York is probably a pretty different place than it is now, huh?
You know, some things stay the same, some things change. But yeah, no, I mean, especially this year, it's definitely different. But yeah, no, it's definitely changed Brooklyn. I mean, I've lived in Brooklyn the whole time I've been here, and that's definitely changed a lot in the last, you know, almost 20 years.
Okay. And when you moved to New York, I guess, what were some of the earliest struggles that you had working as a freelance photographer?
Oh man, all the struggles, trying to pay rent, trying to get jobs. But yeah, and I think the biggest, like when I first moved here, was just trying to create a network of people that I could work with and that, you know, would, I could, you know, would hire me and would also, you know, luckily I had like RIT has a very strong alumni base here in New York City. So that really helped out a lot to kind of get started. I pretty much reached out to all the alumni that are based in New York City. And I was like, hey, I just graduated, would love to work in his assistant. Are you looking for anybody? And, you know, most people were like, yeah, no, whatever, kid. And then, you know, there's a few that were like, yes, absolutely. And that was how I kind of got started assisting, just for mostly RIT grads.
Sure. And do you think like the program at Rochester, do you think that like, they kind of prepared you to work as a freelancer, not just shooting photos, but also like the business end of things? Or was that something that you kind of learned on as you went?
The business was definitely more learned in the real life than it was at school. Like we had one business class, but it was honestly, it was taught by a teacher that basically hadn't been in the industry for like 20 years. So like you know, some things do stay the same, like you do estimate and then you do production and whatever it is. But like the specifics of, oh, this is for social media, this is whatever, like that what they weren't kind of ready for. But I mean, I think to tell everybody, I'd say working in the business at a lower level is the best way to learn the business, you know, before anything else.
Yeah, for sure. And like, I guess when you were starting out, did you have any kind of like mentors or people that you looked up to that kind of showed you the way and kind of guided your career path?
Yeah, I'd say some of the people that I assisted for were definitely those people. They paid me and I worked really hard for these people. And they, you know, some of them, these photographers were the ones that got me my first photo jobs. So they're like, oh, hey, one of my clients needs to do a smaller shoot that, you know, I'm too expensive for it, but hey, Steve will do it real cheap and get, you know, his foot in the door. And some of those people mentored me in two different ways. One in the business side of things, and like, hey, this is how you got to get your portfolio together. This is how you got to get a website and all those things. And some, you know, mentored me in the form of creativity and making sure you're being creative and how you push yourself as a creative entrepreneur, basically. And, you know, separate from that is also just mentoring in life, right? Like this is how these are ways to set goals and ways to, you know, make sure you're staying happy and doing what you love. And, you know, so no, I was really blessed with some really great people that helped me get from one step to the next step or to the next step. You know?
Sure, absolutely. And like when you moved here, were you still shooting on film or was it already digital back then or what?
Right when I kind of moved here right in the switch. So it started with film, you know, and you know, some of the first assisting jobs I did was like loading 4x5 sheet holders. And, you know, like it was kind of a really complicated, you know, like you've learned to work in complete darkness and kind of feel your way through everything. And then pretty quickly, though, I'd say within the first 6 months to year, like I kind of transitioned into digital as the industry was transitioning into digital. You know, I've always been an early adopter of technologies. So I was like, actually at RIT, I had learned about digital because they had some like these like original digital backs that were like, you know, 5 megapixels or something that cost like $100,000 that I had the luck of being able to use in school. And then I also decided to take the RIT also has a printing school. So I took actually what was called a color separation systems class, which is like pre-press, you know, so like I knew a lot about how digital files need to be prepared before they went into, went to press, which like a lot of people didn't have that knowledge. So that really helped me become, you know, work and transition from being like a film photo assistant to a digital tech.
And so at what point did you, I guess, transition from shooting stills to actually shooting motion?
That was basically just like 5 years ago, I think. It was 2016, I think. Yeah. Yeah. So it was just 2016 that I kind of really made the hard switch from going, well, and it was really not just going from stills to video, but also stills to, you know, what I had called visual engineering at the time, which I'm still using that term as well.
Sure. And like, were you shooting, when you started in video, were you shooting primarily products still, or were you kind of like cutting your teeth on other projects before you jumped into paid work for like these big time brands and clients?
Yeah. In still photography, basically I started out doing editorial. So working for magazines, mostly, which, you know, didn't pay a lot, but it was fun. And they trusted you to try to, you know, do the work. And then from editorial, which is magazines, I moved into catalog work actually, cause you know, just cause of my knowledge and, of digital and all, there was a lot of catalogs I wanted to switch to digital like right at first, but people didn't know the technology or it was really expensive. And I was like, oh, I know how it all works and it's like easy for me. So I was able to kind of find, actually Victoria's Secret was the first company that hired me to start shooting catalog for them, product stills though, not like the fancy models. But it was great. Like it gave me that, you know, I had like a studio I shared with another photographer, on 36th Street in Manhattan. And like, we, you know, just started shooting and those, you know, they booked me for weeks at a time. So it was actually an amazing transition going from, you know, still like assisting still photographers to doing, you know, catalog work and stuff like that. So I kind of got really lucky and kind of sucked into the studio a little bit because it's funny enough, my original plan leaving college was to be a travel photographer. So I wanted to just travel and shoot. And I did, you know, some of that work, but pretty quickly I found that food and product and studio was more of my calling in some ways.
Yeah, and also just traveling too. Like it seems sometimes like it's like really cool, especially when you're young, but the more you do it, you realize how exhausting it is. And even though you're going to these exotic places, you're actually not spending too much time in these cities. You're just shooting and then going home. So it's a bit of a grind.
Yeah, totally.
So you mentioned that Victoria's Secret was your first client and you were doing stills for them. Were they also your first like big client when you started doing video as well?
trying to think about how that all worked out. They did definitely hire me to do video eventually, but they weren't the first one. So yeah, so from Victoria's Secret, I then got another catalog called Johnson & Murphy. It's a men's and women's clothing brand that's US based. And I started shooting their catalog as well. And I did that for like 10 years. And then from that, I got other catalogs because they're kind of like, you know, the catalog people all know each other to a certain extent. So I ended up being just shooting a ton of catalog. The editorial kind of slowed down the magazine stuff. But in advertising as well, like I was starting to do more products and food advertising as well. So it was kind of a mix of all those things together. And then when I went into video, I did some video for Victoria's Secret, some for Johnson Murphy. I'd done some work for Macy's and they hired me to do some video for Macy's as well. Definitely some of my existing clients were some of the first ones to like take a chance and just say, hey, you know, how about, you know, doing some video. But I feel like the biggest change I had was when I did my burger drop video that kind of went super viral back in 2016, like that opened the doors to like way more people, a lot, like all over the world that called us, you know, cause they're like, oh, we saw this video you did. We want to hire you to do something kind of like that. So that was kind of like the big like push that started getting me other video jobs. And then along the way, some of my existing clients as well, you know, were giving me some video jobs as well.
Sure. And did you find it like really hard to transition from being a photographer to working in motion? Like what was the learning curve like? What kind of things did you kind of really spend time studying?
Yeah, no, I mean, there are some things that like, it's funny now, like that I'm like, I didn't really understand frame rate. And like, you know, like there's a lot of things where I'm like, why is this 23.98, not 24? And why is it not 30? It should be 60. Like I feel like, you know, project tech, you know, timelines and stuff, just because once again, it was so foreign to me from coming from still photography. Like you just do one frame and you're done. And then, you know, there's definitely a huge learning curve on, you know, how do you move the camera? You know, how do you move it smoothly? How do you pull focus? How do you, you know, do all those things? Which is also incredibly challenging since, you know, like in still photography, it's just this one moment. One place where I kind of got lucky was in my still photography, I was never like a huge Photoshop compositor, like shoot 1,000 different frames and put them together. I was usually the guy that would do it by doing it for real in camera as much as possible, like a little compositing, but pretty straightforward. And, you know, that was lucky because in video, you can't do the compositing as easily. So that was kind of a lucky break that I was already naturally doing that kind of work. Sure. So yeah, I mean, there was definitely a learning curve getting to video, then never mind editing and sound and titles and all the other things that go into it.
Yeah.
And learning how to direct those things, you know, not just like, oh, okay, well, then I'll do the titles. It's like, no, I have to know how I want to integrate those titles into the other stuff and, you know, all of that. So yeah, I mean, I feel like editing is its own thing, you know, and that's something coming from stills into video that was definitely a challenge to learn because it's a completely different skill.
Sure. While we're kind of talking about like education and learning and stuff like that, I read somewhere that you did some classes many years ago at the Third Ward. Now, can you tell the listeners a little bit about what the Third Ward was and what you got out of it?
Yeah. Oh my God, I miss that place so much. Yeah, so I, you know, I'd been doing stills photography. I had my studios doing catalog and all that stuff, and I started getting, you know, bored. And I've always been kind of like a do things with my hands like kind of person, where I always want to be creating and building and creating new things. So I was like, I found this place, Third Ward, that was in Brooklyn and Bushwick, and they had classes in like welding and woodworking and electronic circuits and all sorts of random things. And also like photography and video and, you know, all you name it, like upholstery making and like, you know, make your own shoes. Like it was, this is the awesome creative space, where you could take a class in almost anything kind of fun, you know, figure drawing and any of that stuff. But I was obviously drawn to more of these like kind of technical things of like welding and woodworking and stuff. So I started with a woodworking class, and then from there I took a welding class, and then from there I took another welding class, and then I ended up for years like always taking a night class basically. So it was like once or twice a week I would go, and I would have like, you know, my school night, you know, where I would go after, you know, assisting or shooting or whatever I was doing, and I would go take classes. And that's kind of where the excitement for visual engineering really came from. So it's like, how do I combine my photography knowledge with all these technology, like this, you know, building and making contraptions and circuits and Arduino and all this stuff I had learned from the Third Ward, and kind of combine them together into a video format, you know. And that's really where that burger drop video was born. It was like, oh, like, how do I apply all these technical skills with the photography to tell the story through slow motion video? And, you know, it kind of like, it was like a really eye-opening moment in my career where I was like, well, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. Like, I forget all the other stuff I've done, the catalog or whatever. That was great. And I learned a lot from that. And I couldn't have done what I do now without that experience. But like, it kind of like just clicked for me. That's like, all right, this is what I should be doing. This is what I should concentrate on. I'm going to really push away from still photography and go into this thing called visual engineering that, you know, only a few people were using that term in the world at that time. And I'm just like, it really describes what I do. It's just like partially the, you know, making the devices that do the crazy things and telling the story. So yeah. It's kind of a fun moment for me. And I think, you know, for people listening, like think about it for yourself. Like, are there skills that you love that and hobbies and things that you do that you're not applying to the work that you do? Is there a way to apply it to the work that you want to do? And it's kind of like what I would call now like my superpower, where I really just like brought all the things I love in life together in a way to do something that actually could get paid for, which is also, you know, part of that challenge. But yeah, no, I mean, the Third Ward was really a really pivotal. Well, I would actually have to say continuing ed courses in general have been super pivotal to the work I've done, because, you know, past the Third Ward, I took like the Arduino class that I took to help me learn how to, actually at Cooper Union, they had continuing courses, and I took an Arduino class there, which taught me how to do the coding and everything for the burger drop video. And then I also, after that, have taken classes in Maya and 3D software is a, you know, new school. So like, it's all over the city. Like, you gotta, you know, find the courses, but there's a lot of fun stuff out there. And it really just gets your mind moving. It gets you excited about trying new things. And it's a big, reason why we started now the Garage Learning, which is our own, you know, online course, like teaching, basically online, you know, school teaching the visual engineering, because like I want to give back the way that people gave back to me with sharing knowledge and teaching. And there's just not a great resource for people trying to learn about all the work that we do with, you know, robotics and stepper motors and pneumatics and all the stuff we use to make visuals, never mind also understanding the business of what we do as well, you know. So I'm really excited to launch it officially in June coming up next month. And, you know, try to empower other people to do really cool stuff.
Yeah, for sure. It's, you know, now that you mention it, like, for years, I remember, like, when I was sitting at Gary's Loft Studio in Manhattan, like, I think it was 2016 or 2017, and this grip came over to me and was like, dude, check this out. And he shows me on his phone. It was an Instagram account. And I guess it was your Instagram account or someone that shared your video of you showing the behind the scenes of that s'mores video. And I just remember like being blown away by how cool that looked. And, you know, not only do you kind of use your social media to market yourself, but you also use it to educate people, and you show your process, and you're not, you know, closed source. You're very open source, and you're very you'd like to help people, I guess, learn about your process. So now that you're talking about the Garage Learning, what is it exactly, and like, how do people learn? Like, what do people take away from the courses?
So Garage Learning was born out of, you know, what we just talked about, me wanting to share our knowledge with the world, which is, you know, a lot of what we do on my Instagram channel and YouTube channels as well. We've been toying with the idea for a few years, but, you know, luckily for better or worse, it got accelerated with the pandemic, where, you know, we were already planning to do a Kickstarter campaign to raise money to fund the creation of this. And thanks to the pandemic, that, you know, no jobs were happening for a while. So me and my whole full-time team, we all just went home and started making educational content from our basements, our apartments, you know, wherever we had space. And then back in November of last year, we launched Kickstarter. We raised over $400,000.
Wow.
From two types of sales. One was, you know, basically year-long subscriptions to our online courses. in beginner, intermediate, and advanced levels. And then we also made some DIY kits where basically you learn how to make your own LED lights, you learn how to make your own pan tilt slider, you make your own turntables. And we kind of, it's these kind of kits that are all like custom made parts and everything, and you just assemble them yourself. And in that, you learn how to apply that knowledge on how these things work. Because the core to the work that we do is customization. You know, like if you just bought a slider off the shelf, you don't understand how, you understand how to make it move, but you don't understand how it works.
Yeah.
So the goal with all our kits is to, you know, literally teach people how these things work and also give them a tool that they could use as well, and the tool that they could customize. You know, so like the turntable kit isn't just a turntable. You could actually turn it on its side and you can mount like a bottle of liquid to it, and now it would be your pouring device to pour, you know, a beer or liquor shoot or something like that. If the same kit could also, you know, pull a fishing line string on a spool to like move something across the table. So yeah, no, they're really fun. And I feel like just the classes themselves, like, wouldn't be as much nearly as educational and as fun as the classes plus the kits together. So, yeah, basically the garagelearning.com is the website where you learn more about it. Yeah, we're finally, now that the Kickstarter is over and we raised the money, we've been shooting classes for the last few months, and we're going to be continuing to shoot new classes every month going forward. And I hope to make it a really awesome, you know, resource for people. And we're going to continue to also make new kits that do new things and add on packages that they can add on to their kits, so they could like make their pan tilt slider do something different. You know, so sure. It's really fun because I feel like nobody else is kind of taking this approach. It's either like they're just teaching you a class or they're selling you a product, but like we really want to break down those lines and really, you know, bridge the gap between a product that you just turn on and use and a product that you understand the ins and outs of how it works.
Sure. And how do students do the classes? Is it like a virtual, like online, or is it like an app or what?
Yeah, so they'll be on the website that's going to launch in June. So they log in, and we're actually using Adobe Captivate, which is a learning management system. So basically, it's kind of like a masterclass where you log in, and then you have the choice of the courses, and they're all pre-recorded videos. Mm-hmm. And then in there's also assignments, and there's also a social aspect where you could do an assignment, you could upload it, and other members could comment and look at it and like it and, you know, discuss and share, which I think that's the other thing too we really wanted to build was just is community.
Yeah.
Too, where people have a place to bounce off their videos that's not like the shark infested waters of, you know, social media per se, where it's like anybody could say anything, but, you know, here is kind of more of a safe space where, you know, people can share work and get, you know, feedback from, you know, their peers, whether you're an intermediate student getting feedback from the pros or actually getting feedback from our team. You know, we're going to weigh in on projects as well. And along with that, we've also had some scholarships as well.
Sure.
We're really trying to reach a global audience, to not just be limited to people just in New York City, like, mm-hmm. where like in-person classes are so limited that way, where, you know, you would have to live here to do it. Where we wanted to basically to give access to people all over the world.
Yeah, I think like this past year has just kind of taught us how, you know, education doesn't necessarily need to be limited to a classroom. It's so scalable if you can figure out how to apply it to, you know, shooting and video or photos and put it online. And I think a lot of schools and universities are going to start really adopting that and running with it in the years to come. I work as a gaffer or a filmmaker or a photographer. I don't have any background in doing coding or working with computers on, you know, like a deep level. Do I need to have any kind of background to do these kinds of classes?
No, I mean, I didn't have a background when I started, and we're designing these courses to literally hold your hand. Like the beginner level courses are literally designed for people that their only camera is a smartphone, mm-hmm. That they're only going to use stuff that they could find around the house, you know, like bungee cord and, you know, wood and some screws, and, you know, like we're trying to keep it as simple as possible. You know, intermediate, then you need a better camera, you need some lights, you need some stands, you know, like a little more, and then, you know, getting into the pros, you know, we're expecting that you have pro level equipment and you're doing this for a living.
Sure.
But for most people, no, like we'll basically take you from, you know, step one all the way through. We've also made it so you don't actually have to program an Arduino to run the kits as well. So the kits are actually going to run a software that is already made, that's beautiful, has a nice GUI and everything. So it's basically going to be a lot easier than my first experience trying to get into this. We're basically trying to do it so that we can accelerate a student's learning curve way past the amount of time it took me to do things.
Sure.
With that, they're going to have to put in the time, though. I mean, there's no replacement for putting the time in your garage, messing around, making a mess, and just failing and learning from your failures and learning how to move forward. I think there's a lot of people that just like, oh, I just want to learn the thing and do the thing. And it's like, well, no, you gotta learn how to apply the thing and how to, you know, kind of move, you know, past that. So, for the right person, if they have the passion, there's no real prerequisite to get started.
Sure. So you work in something and you specialize in something called MoCo. Can you just explain to our listeners who aren't familiar with MoCo, like, what is it and how does it work?
Yeah, MoCo is short for motion control. So basically, motion control is any sort of controlled motion of an object, activity, action, whatever you name it. It's mostly deals with using motors to move things and in a very repeatable way. It could also be pneumatics, which is like air powered cylinders or hydraulics or anything that's kind of used in industrial automation, basically, is where motion control originally originated. So like the conveyor belts and the motors and stuff like that, that's where a lot of this stuff started. So yeah, I mean, a lot of like the robots we use these industrial robots that have cameras on them. They're basically car factory robots. So they were designed for, you know, doing those kinds of tasks because they have to be incredibly repeatable, you know, where like, oh, if you're making a car, like you want to make sure it welds the same spot every time. They also have to be fast because the time, you know, time is money when you're doing bulk, creating things in bulk. So it's really important that they, you know, weld and then weld again and again and again and work really fast. So that's why these industrial robots that we use are also really fast, which is great because it lets us do some really cool stuff.
Sure. Yeah. So one question that I had, I've been watching a bunch of your videos on your Instagram, and these robots kind of pick up like cameras, they move lights and they pick up like a really, you know, sensitive objects like a rocks glass or like a martini glass or whatever. How do you control these robots from like crushing these, you know, really delicate objects? Like I would feel really hesitant to give my Phantom camera to a robot and have it like shake it around and move it. Is that something you guys program, or is the learning of the robot itself, does it calculate that on its own? How does that work?
Yeah, robot smash. The software that runs the robots is designed by Mark Roberts Motion Control in the UK, and it's designed to make these robots camera robots. So it's designed for photographers, DPs, directors to use them and understand how to use them. But there are also a lot of safety, you know, built into them. So it's not like you're just like telling it like, go. It's like it actually, on the screen, it shows you the path it's going to take between the different points. Because basically, it's basically just waypoints. So you're saying, here's point one, here's point two, here's point three. And then it just connects the dots and makes the move through those points. So it's not going to like just go somewhere totally different. Like it really listens to what you tell it to do. It's also really dumb. So if I told it to smash the table by mistake, as I put a point at the bottom of the table or whatever, it'll do that. So we have an experienced operator that operates it. I also know how to operate the software as well. We actually also have, for other people out there in New York City, especially, thegaragerentals.com is our company that rents the robots and the studio space itself for other people, other productions that want to use the robots and the space and the technology that we've created. But with that, it's not necessarily a rental where you're like, okay, here you go, pick up the robot, take it with you. Like, it's a service like where we supply an operator with it. Our operator should be involved in the pre-production meetings and everything to kind of make sure that we're prepared to think the right robot can do the right move that it's needed at the right speed and all the things. It basically replaces the camera operator and, you know, the dolly grip and all those things. And it's pulling focus for you. It's basically doing the job of about four people on set, but there's still that one person that's doing that, right? Yeah. That's programming the robot. So it's not like it magically does it. You still need a very, you know, established person to do that kind of work.
Yeah, so that brings me to my next question. What's your core team look like? Like, you know, the traditional shoots have like a gaffer and a sound person and you know, a bunch of stylists and stuff like that. Like, you operate in a studio and you do primarily product stuff. Like, what does your team look like when you're doing these different kinds of shoots?
Yeah, no, I mean, so another segue for you here. So as far as gaffer goes, we mostly use our own custom built lights, you know, so since we shoot like crazy slow motion and we're shooting on these, you know, robots and all that stuff, traditional lights kind of are really big and get in the way of the robot movements. And they also, you know, basically with high speed, you have kind of two options. Usually you have, you know, if you're shooting 1,000 frames a second, you know, you have tungsten, which is super inefficient. So you're using 10Ks or 20Ks and it's just like cooking everything. Or you have HMI. The HMI has issues with flicker. You know, even the high-speed, awesome RE electronic ballasts still have flicker issues, depending. Plus, you can't turn them on and off, so now you're just cooking, you know, like the whole set and everything going on. So we, you know, early on in my exploration of high-speed, I started playing with building my own LED lights because I feel like LED has the ability to bridge the gap between those other two light sources, something that you could dim up and down, something that is still very powerful and efficient like an HMI, but without the flicker. So our in-house lights are, you know, similar to like an M18 HMI in output, but they weigh like 4 pounds. They're tiny. They I could dim them from, you know, 1 watt to the 1800 watts, flicker free. They're super efficient. They're tiny. They basically solve all the problems that I have. I don't recommend them necessarily to your average shoot. But with that, like, I can't use a traditional gaffer in that they don't know our lights, which is a bit of a problem. So we have two people that we use regularly that know my lighting system that, you know, they actually were photo assistants that came into being more of a gaffer. And then, you know, yeah, so like one of our traditional shoots, so let's say we'd have like a gaffer, we'd have a grip, we would have a motion control operator on the robot, we'll have DIT, we'll have an AC, a lot of the times, not always, because, you know, a lot is done by the robot in so many ways. And then a couple of PAs, like, yeah, I mean, our teams, and then plus, you know, obviously art direction, styling, all the other departments. But as far as our core team is pretty small, it's under 10 people, usually for most shoots that we do. Because, yeah, we're not rolling sound. We're usually shooting slow motion, you know, on the shoots that we do. So, you know, that and a lot of times with Phantom camera, like, you can't really slate things either because of the buffer size, and you know, could only record for a certain amount of time. So it's like we you know, maybe one in five shoots we actually have to slate it because we're maybe not shooting on the Phantom, we're shooting on a Red or Mini or something. So it's a very different and very unique workflow and place that we work in, you know, because it's really like the type of work we're doing is very unique and different than what your traditional cinematographer would do, like out on location shooting, you know, models or talent, you know, talking and, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah. So from my experience, like working with these Phantom cameras, like you said, they do require a ton of light. And traditionally, it's just all been HMIs and stuff like that. And we have these huge lights that burn really hot. It cooks the studio. Are you able to get the same, similar output with the LED lights?
Yeah, so like the output of our lights is the same as an M18 HMI.
Wow.
Awesome. Which is pretty good. We're working on a bigger version now, like a 4K version. And then what we end up doing is if we need more light, we group a few of them together because they're so small.
Sure.
Like they're literally the size, for any still photographers out there, the size of like a Pro Photo light head.
Okay.
So we could put, you know, two of them together. And now we have almost a 4K. We put four of them together. We have almost, you know, like a 6K or 8K.
Yeah.
Basically we only really rent lights most of the time when we need something like 9K or above, or six, even 6K sometimes.
Okay.
But otherwise, yeah, we have the same kind of output, which is kind of crazy.
That's amazing. And in terms of like lenses, do you have like your go-to set of lenses for most of your jobs, or does it change from job to job?
Yeah, we own some in-house glass, which is mostly stuff that's suited for macro and suited for, you know, not being some monster lenses that work well on the robots too. Because we're, you know, if you're trying to use a huge zoom, now you got to move that thing around and things could get shakier and stuff. We have like some crazy probe lenses and microscope lenses. And then we also use like the Zeiss CB2 50 millimeter macro that they don't make anymore, but it's a great overall macro lens. And then we have some wide zooms that we like as well. Because like for us, it's all about close focus distance. It's such a big part of what we do. Like a lot of these lenses that have, you know, 12 or 18 inch close focus distances don't really work. We need to be like, you know, ideally 10 inches or so or closer, you know. So, we definitely have a set of lenses in-house.
Cool. And like when I look at your videos, they look super elegant and polished and smooth, but people probably don't see the amount of work that goes into pulling off those really nice shots. What's the most tedious part of your process?
It's the whole process. I think there's so many challenges in like not just getting the action right, which is usually the first step that we're trying to get, like whether it's a liquid pour, an explosion, or whatever is happening, you know, getting that right along with then the camera move and the timing of everything, and then making sure it's lit beautifully. And then we're pulling out people ask like, oh yeah, so is it like mostly lighting or mostly like the technical stuff? You know, and it's really like equal 33% of like the business side of things and running the production well, 33% is the like technical engineering stuff, and 33% is the cinematography, storytelling, creative side of it. So it's really, if all three of those aren't done right, then it falls flat, you know, so, or you don't get hired again. Sure. So it's definitely not something for somebody that's just getting started to get. They're not going to get it perfect at first. Like, it just takes a lot of practice to kind of get there and get it to be, you know, really perfect and beautifully polished.
Sure. And so obviously you work as a commercial product photographer, tabletop photographer. What kinds of relationships would you say are important for someone that's looking to get into cinematography and shoot those kinds of pieces of work?
I think it's really important to have a team, right? Like, I have the stylist, like art direction and styling is so important, you know, like, because you can have beautiful light, but if what you're shooting doesn't look great, like it's a big challenge. So like, especially in food and beverage. So having good stylists, having a good team of grips and gaffers and you know, an AD and all that stuff to help you execute is also super important. But I think for you know, more than anything, is just having a community of people that you could talk to, show your work to, do tests with. You know, like, testing is so important to shoot stuff like that. And you know, I think the team is super important. Like, without like my head rigger Matt, who actually now is the one that builds all the rigs and all that stuff, like I could never get everything done. You know, like, we, and same thing with my producer and our robot operator. Like, it's just, without those people, it would be impossible for me to do the work that we do, or at least as many jobs as we do.
Sure. And when you say like rigger, like, you mean like he's setting up like the robots or like the platforms that pop things up or what?
Well, he's like as an example, the Hershey S'mores video we did, like, he's the one that built the little contraption that made all the pieces move and spin together. So he's kind of like a special effects rigger, basically, where he's just, you know, making the devices that spin and throw things and like the catapults and all that stuff. So he's separate from the guy that operates the robot. You know, they're basically two different roles.
Okay. And have you guys ever like destroyed any pieces of like film gear in the process of just testing and experimenting?
We have. There's been a few instances between, because we work around liquids a lot, and that has its challenges. So we had one lens that drank some Pepsi once. Wow. Where like there's a container, like we're shooting up, looking up from the ground, like up, and there's a, like at the bottom of a tank, a liquid, and the one of the Carlini clamps slipped, and it just like all the liquid went right into the lens. Wow. Luckily it wasn't too fancy of a lens. Okay. We also had the robot smash into a set once, and luckily it all worked, the Phantom was fine, it all worked out, like we were able to actually salvage everything. But yeah, no, I mean, when we're working in such close distance to things, you know, like sometimes like we're so close to everything happening that it's inevitable that eventually you'll bump into some things. The hope is that where the more you do it, the better you get at it, the less you're going to do it. So we've been pretty good lately and not destroying anything.
Sure. I assume insurance covers that kind of stuff, I guess, when
the lens breaks. I mean, if it's expensive enough, it's worth going to the insurance. Luckily, none of the things right now have been over like $1,000 or so.
Sure.
For repair costs or whatever, so it's not really worth pulling it. But yes, that's why we have good insurance.
Yeah, good to have. So you work primarily out of a studio. So to me, theoretically, you could live and work pretty much anywhere. What keeps you here in New York?
The talent, you know, because it's not just me, right? You know, as much as it's a studio, we need the good stylists, we need the great prop rental bits, we need the rest of the team as well, which really keeps us here in New York. I mean, yes, I could be in Chicago or LA or maybe Atlanta or Miami or San Francisco. I have like those options, but it has to be, you need the talent. You know, without the talent, you're nowhere, because like me by myself, I can't do all the jobs, you know.
Sure. And do you have like any kind of like rental houses that you work closely with that you just like love working with here in New York?
We rent from Scheinpflug a good amount because they do stills and video. We rent from Adorama sometimes. We rent from Photo Care for still things as well. But honestly, we own most of the stuff in Able. And right here now in Industry City, Able Cinema is where we go for any lenses and cameras we need on top of what we own. But honestly, most jobs, we're not renting a whole lot.
Sure.
You know, we really own a lot of the stuff we use.
Very cool. When did you guys make the move to Industry City?
In February, March, something like that. Yeah, I forget exactly. I think end of February it was. Yeah.
Okay. So like right before the pandemic.
No, after the pandemic, just this February.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Like 3 months ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. It was supposed to happen in the middle of, like by the end of last year, or actually we were hoping to move by the fall of last year, but with the pandemic, everything got pushed back. Construction took longer, everything. But yeah, but now we're here at Industry City and super excited to be here. The new space is awesome.
Yeah, I mean, Industry City is now kind of becoming like an epicenter of production in here in New York. So a bunch of like rental houses and studios have been opening up around there. So that's great. So March 13th, 2020, Corona happens. How did everything play out for you guys?
We were on a job that week. We were supposed to go to LA the week after to do another job. That all got canceled. We had a few other jobs that were already on hold and even confirmed that got canceled. So we all went to our homes, and because I have at that time I had a full-time team of four or five, I forget exactly, of us. So we all just started shooting education content. And that was in March. Come May, basically we didn't shoot any jobs in May, April. We were just shooting education content in May. We got asked to do a few jobs, and I actually shot, I live in Brooklyn, but I have a house upstate in Sullivan County, New York. So I actually shot a job for Budweiser that was just me and a stylist at my house upstate. So I was working from home. And that was like a national TV Budweiser job. We ended up coming to the studio to shoot a few things because it just wasn't working out up there with the same thing, just like a three-person team. And then going into May, we started doing some more jobs with like four-person teams, all national TV mostly. And then come June, start picking up again a little bit more, but we got up to like a 10-person team, I think, on some jobs. And then come July, we kind of came back to the studio, like with the full-time team. And we're just like, I mean, the producer, people, they didn't have to touch cameras or things, stayed home.
Sure.
But the people, like we, without the robots, the cameras, the stuff, the lights, we can't produce.
Yeah.
So come like after July 4th, we kind of were back in the studio, and we had, safety protocols in place, and, PCR tests and all this stuff. And then we started, in all our shoots, we still have, all the quick tests and PCRs ahead, and the nurse that comes and all the stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but clients aren't really coming, which is fine. Like we've got a great remote workflow. Cause like with tabletop, it's like, half the time I'm like, why do they come anyway?
Yeah,
and I think some of that might stay, but there's always going to be the clients that want to come back, So, it's interesting that way.
Yeah. I bought this like $50 little like switcher by Blackmagic, and I just pipe in all the clients for a lot of the jobs that we do now remotely. And I'm like, why weren't we doing this like years ago? Cause it's so easy and you don't have people that don't need to be there just standing around and, eating all the crafty basically. So, yeah. Let's see here. So what shoot have you done that you're the most proudest of?
Oh man, so many good shoots. We just wrapped one that I can't tell you about that was really, really exciting. Yeah, for me, it's always like the next shoot's the most exciting one because I'm like, anything I've done already is like in the past. But as far as like shoots that were really important to get us to where we are today, would be the Hershey Spores video you mentioned, the Burger Drop video that I did, because that was just a test self-produced. And that was such a pivotal point in my career. And then I think the work we did for Pepsi Black a couple years ago, which was a global campaign, which is like one of the biggest campaigns we've ever did, and where they really leaned on us as creatives and execution, you know, for us to come up with like what crazy stuff that looks amazing can we do with Pepsi Black? And then, you know, how do we execute that? And, you know, we also had an amazing team at Buck TV, which is also here in Industry City as well, that worked with us on that campaign for the motion graphics and the little bits of CG that were in there and the final edit. And, you know, that work just was super pivotal in pushing us into doing way more beverage work all around the world.
Sure. And now that you mentioned, you know, talking to clients about some stuff, a lot of the stuff that you do is so kind of far out there and conceptual. Do you have a hard time kind of explaining to clients like what you're going to do for them? Or are you at the point now where they kind of just trust you, they give you a general idea and you kind of make it happen?
Oh, there's some reoccurring clients have more trust, but even with that, every single job pretty much has, I have to do a full treatment and really kind of break down in storyboards. And because it's like so much of what we're trying to do has not been done before. So it's not like there's a good reference in stock or something I could show them. So we do a lot of storyboards. Sometimes we'll actually shoot a test shot to show them, because we own all the stuff, we have it here, and just be like, this is what we mean by this camera move, like this is what this camera move is going to look like, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think explaining it is a skill and part of the process, and also coming up with the ideas too. Like we get people don't hire me for the boring shoots. You know, like most of the people that come to us for something, you know, new and you know, innovative. So with that comes the challenges of always innovating and coming up with new things.
One question that I always like to ask is like, how much of your career kind of stems from hard work, and how much of it stems from just pure luck?
The Guy Raz question.
Oh yeah, exactly.
Which he's amazing.
Yeah.
This is good. This is practice for when I get on that show. So
exactly.
I think a lot of it definitely comes to hard work, but there's definitely luck involved, you know, being in the right place at the right time. You know, even like when I moved to New York and it's like the verge of digital and I already taken digital classes, and, you know, having taken these classes at Third Ward, you know, just as I was getting bored of still photography and like, you know, the Phantom camera was out and robots were becoming used more, like, you know, so I always say, you know, you make your own luck by working hard, but you can never, you know, you can never plan on when the luck shows up. You know, the best thing you do is just keep pushing forward every day and trying to do your best work. And I definitely work incredibly hard, you know, and you know, make sure that I have a team that's also working really hard, because or else, you know, somebody out there is willing to work harder.
Sure,
so
sure.
I think so much success comes from a little bit of both.
Sure. Okay, last question. Who's in charge of cleaning up all your shoots after you're done?
It's a group effort.
Okay.
It really is a little bit of everybody, but we have an amazing cleaning lady here at Industry City as well. It's a mix of the grip and the gaffer team and the special effects rigging team that kind of work together, because we all kind of made the mess together to clean up after a shoot, and the PAs as well. You will still find me with a mop in hand. Sometimes I feel bad. I'm like, I made such a mess in this place.
Yeah.
So I'm not too proud to mop up my own mess.
Sure. I can just imagine like the look on the cleaning lady's face when she shows up post shoot when there's Pepsi and all this stuff all over the floor. So
sticky stuff is the worst. Chocolate and milk. Oh god, milk when it gets like it starts smelling bad. It's the worst.
Okay, well, cool, man. Well, thank you so much for your time. What's the best way for people to find you? I guess on social media, on the web.
Yes, I'm very complicated on so many ways, but basically, our production company, The Garage, it's the dash garage. Massage.tv, where you find the website, which will give you the Instagram and everything else. For our learning company, thegaragelearning.com. For our rentals company, thegaragerentals.com. And then each of those have their own Instagram. But if you want to find me personally, Instagram at Steve Giralt is the best way to find me, DM me, you know, see the behind the scenes of the work that I do.
Amazing. Okay, well, cool. I'll definitely try to put them in the show notes for other people to be able to find you and learn more about the garage and your process.
Awesome. Thanks.
Amazing. Well, thanks so much for being on the show, and we'll talk soon.
Cool. Thanks, Tom. Take care.
This week's episode is sponsored by my lighting company, MasterShot Films. Since 2008, thousands of productions have entrusted the MasterShot team to deliver and operate all of the lighting equipment for their interviews, branded content, and social media videos. Our gaffers and key grips deliver anywhere in the tri-state area. Visit MasterShotFilms.com to see a virtual tour of our G&E vans and to see some BTS videos of our lighting setups that we've lit over the years. Save 10% on your first booking by using the promo code NYCVideoPodcast. And that's a wrap on today's talk with Steve Giralt. It's incredible to see and talk about all these innovative techniques that Steve and his team are developing there at the garage and how they're pushing the boundaries of what's possible when shooting simple pieces of food or a soda can. I've personally worked on countless product and food shots, and believe me, the process can get really boring and stale after a few years. It's nice to see how Steve and others out there are embracing technology and incorporating it into their craft and pushing the boundaries of what's possible in food and product photography. It also makes me wonder how our relationship and understanding of robots will change in regards to video production. Be sure to check out Steve's Instagram page to see behind-the-scenes videos of what he's shooting and directing. Also, if you're interested in learning about Steve's process and how to build your own Moco rigs, check out the links in the show notes to learn more about the Garage Learning's virtual workshop that Steve and his team are producing. Lastly, be sure to subscribe to our show so you're alerted every time we put out new episodes where we'll be interviewing other local video and film professionals and learn about their experiences working here in New York. If you have questions or a theme that you'd like us to explore on a future episode, shoot us a DM on Instagram at NYCVideoPodcast. If you're interested in running a sponsored ad for your business and engaging with the New York film and video community, amazing. Email us at nycvideopodcast@gmail.com. Until next week, I'm Tom Chavez, and you're listening to the NYC Video Podcast. I'll see you on set.